Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. On this edition of our program, we offer another installment in our ongoing Museum Confidential podcast series. The podcast is co-created by myself and Jeff Martin of Philbrook Museum twice a month here at Public Radio Tulsa. And this time out, we offer a show that was actually recorded before a live audience here in Tulsa at Philbrook back in January. At that time, we spoke with the senior curator at Gilcrease, Laura Fry, and the chief curator at Philbrook, Catherine Whitney, about what it means to be a curator today, what that word really means, and the work that goes into being a curator. Also, please note that tomorrow, that is Friday, we will offer a new installment of our podcast online at publicradiotulsa.org or at iTunes, Spotify, or the NPR One app. And the podcast tomorrow will feature another interview recorded before a live audience, this time in New Orleans earlier this month. Again, that's at publicradiotulsa.org, and then look for the podcast tab or go to Spotify, iTunes, or the NPR One app, where you can find any of the Museum Confidential podcasts we have created thus far. And by the way, we're about to wrap up our second season of the podcast. And so, thank you again for tuning in for Studio Tulsa. This is Museum Confidential.
But I'm telling you right now, I've decided something. I'm 29 years old, everybody, and I'm done pretending I like the museum. I don't like it. I'm a grown man. There's all this pressure. You want a museum? Yeah. Museum? Yeah. Walk around? All day? Yeah. All day. Just meandering aimlessly? Looking at stuff? Being quiet? Stuff I don't understand? Yeah. Be quiet. Yeah. I'll have to pee the whole time. Yeah. I'll be exhausted at the end. Yeah. Saturday? Yeah. All day? No. I don't want to go. I'm a grown man. I don't have to go. I'm not going. I don't care about the museum. I only care that people think I'm the kind of guy who goes to museums. That's all I care about. I go to the Met. I get that little pin. I forget to take it off all week. I'm like this. Yeah, I was at the museum. I was quiet and I sketched. And I got it. Whatever it is grown-ups are doing, that's what I did.
There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Nowadays, it seems like everything is curated. Menus at restaurants, playlists on your smartphone, personal shopping, everything. The word is becoming borderline ubiquitous. Your grandmother probably went her whole life without saying she curated something. And while so many people these days claim to curate this or that, the only ones that can truly own the title are actual curators. But what do they do? What does it mean to be a curator in the traditional sense of the word? Earlier this year, we did our first live show in front of an audience and had the great pleasure to chat about these questions and more with Philbrook Museum of Art Chief Curator Catherine Whitney and Gilcrease Museum Senior Curator Laura Fry.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for being here. So let's dive right into it. We hear this word curate a lot. In today's culture, everything is kind of curated, you know, like a playlist on Spotify or, you know, someone's doing something on Pinterest. They're curating their Pinterest board. Everything is kind of open to that now. But what does it actually mean in the traditional sense? Catherine, why don't you start kind of by telling us what that word means and how you actually do your job?
Well, I like to say it started with us. And popular culture,
the OG
appropriated
curated,
the word, but you do hear the word curate an experience, as you said, curating a playlist, curating an experience, and I think in our field it means compiling, researching, presenting artworks in a very cohesive, engaging way, usually around a certain theme. And again, it's about the artwork and something that can be consumable and hopefully something that's fun, but also teaches somebody about the work, the history, the practice of the artist.
Laura, when you were a little girl, did you dream of being a curator? Did you tell your parents, like, you know, I want to be a curator. I don't want to be a princess or a firefighter or an astronaut. Curating is where I'm going.
Well, I totally did not want to be a princess. I think I thought I might be an artist someday, and in some ways I still get to do a lot of designing as a curator, but my mom tells me that when I was a little kid, I would be really careful while playing with my stuffed animals and Barbie dolls and even like arrange them into little dioramas and like make sure that my little brother didn't touch them. So I think maybe I was destined to do this.
Does that mean that there is an element of control freak? And feel free, either one of you, to answer this in your average curator.
I don't know if I qualify. When I was little, I wanted to be a tambourine player or a hula dancer, so I don't know if I'm in the right profession. But
you could technically be both, I think. You
know. Yeah, I think it adds the kind of spontaneity that we need. Yeah. So the question was again?
Are curators control freaks is the question here. Don't try to dodge the question.
Do we have to answer that?
Do we have to answer that? Well, I would like to go back, actually, to talk about the origins of how you got into this. When you were in school, how did this pathway present itself to you? Maybe, Laura, you want to start with that kind of...
Sure. Well, I was always interested in art from a young age, and I went to school for a BFA. I have a BFA in sculpture and ceramics with a minor in art history. And, you know, making it as a professional artist is a really challenging role. You've got to be a really astute business person. I really admire anyone out there today who's a contemporary artist and making that their living, because it's really difficult. So next time you see an artist, like, shake their hand and tell them they're doing awesome. I'm also was always really interested in history and in storytelling. And I went back for a master's in art history and museum studies with the intent to work in museums. And museums have been spaces I've always loved. I was always like, I was like the odd little kid that you couldn't get out of a museum. Like, most kids are like way too antsy. But it was a great mesh of some of my interests with visual art and design and also history, storytelling, and really being able to reach the public through the like venue of a museum and reaching this broader audience.
And how about you, Catherine? How did you end up on this stage tonight?
I drew constantly as a child. I was the kid that when I went to the grandmother's house, all the crayons and all the new markers and the art set was laid out, and it was my job to create some artwork for my grandmother, so I held her responsible. Also, talking about not being able to leave, my family went to Europe when we were 10, and I was the youngest of all my three siblings, and my siblings were terribly bored and said, why can't we go to Disneyland? And my mom couldn't get me out of the German churches. I would just lie in the pews and look at the painted ceilings, and knew at that point that art was going to be a part of what I did. So I, like you, did a combined double major in studio art and art history, which I think is really important for training your eye and kind of getting yourself confident for composition and knowing what you like. And I wanted to go into museum education and then decided last minute to do art history and went back for graduate school in that, ended up doing some museum work and was actually an art dealer for about 15 years.
At a commercial gallery.
Yep, and worked with artists directly and donors and collectors. And so that was really fun, but I really knew I needed to get back to museum work, and that's what I really wanted to do.
A lot of times when I'm visiting a museum, I'm often thinking, of course, about the things that I'm seeing there, but also about what's not in the museum, because the editing is a huge component of curating. And it's certainly a subjective, you know, obviously you're basing everything on a tradition of certain art histories, but whatever area that you're focusing on, it's very subjective. How do you go about making determinations about what is good? Laura, you want to start with that?
Well, it's subjective. There's a lot of factors that go into deciding what to put on the walls or in a gallery, in a museum, and it really comes down to the story and the concept you're trying to convey. And I think that's one of the differences between, say, curating a museum exhibition and curating your Pinterest page or your Starbucks snack selection, which they totally do. It says, like, curated selections here. But in museums, we're using these objects and choosing these objects, creating this checklist with the intent to tell a story and a narrative and to drive home a key message. And sometimes that is with, say, a work of art that might be considered the pinnacle of an artist's career. Sometimes it's with a more minor piece, or it's a subject matter that helps us get across some of the stories. So it's not necessarily looking for the piece that's going to fetch the highest price at auction or the artist that has the widest name recognition. It might be a wide variety of factors that helps us make that decision.
Yeah. Same to you, Catherine. How do you know what's good?
I think it doesn't have to be, as Laura said, maybe the highest, most valuable painting in terms of the marketplace. Lots of times you'll deal with your own collection and what you have, and that limits what you have or what you can get for a loan. But for me, it is a work that can get across the theme or the message, the idea, and really stop you and make you think. It doesn't necessarily have to be the best, but it can be something that you think about later. It can be something that bothers you. And sometimes those are the most impactful pieces because, you know, why do I like this artist? I kind of like it. I kind of hate it. What is it about it that makes me stop and think or changes, stops you in your tracks, makes you look or makes you wonder?
Well, it seems like, you know, hating something and loving something are both very interesting. It's the middle ground, that kind of blandness that I think we're bombarded with a lot of the times. When you're putting together a show or thinking about a show, of course, putting together is like way many steps down the line, but you have to conceive of the idea. And you both have worked on many, many shows. Do you think of them in aggregate, like a body of work, you know? Do you think of all the shows you've done as some kind of reflection of you and your interest level? Catherine, you want to dive into that?
I think of them sort of as chapters of my life. I will look back and say, oh, the Max Weber show, that was 2012. It wasn't, oh, my daughter was in sixth grade. It was, oh, that was the Weber show. And I'll remember my life sometimes according to my projects. And lots of times these projects are driven by things that are of interest to you or something that you haven't quite thought about but you want to expand into. So it's not just necessarily what you love and your area of interest. I think if any good curator is always growing, they're pushing beyond what they do to learn more.
Laura, I play this game with myself a lot, which is called Best and Favorite. And Best and Favorite is, I'll give you an example. My favorite Bob Dylan album is Nashville Skyline, but it's not the best. The best one to me is Blonde on Blonde, okay? But I'd prefer, if I'm on a desert island, to be stuck with a copy of Nashville Skyline. So I'm able to kind of have a favorite that I know because maybe it has nostalgia for me or it has a personal meaning to me, but I can see objectively that it's maybe not the greatest artistic achievement. Do you have that same kind of way of looking at the artwork that you are, you know, kind of dealing with, or anything in that range?
It's really difficult to pick a favorite, say, you know, out of the Gilcrease collection, which has so many wonderful works. I've got like 15 favorites, so probably more. I don't quite think of it in those terms. I think more in terms of, I have some of the artists who I'm really fascinated by or particular works, but it's pretty fluid. It's versus a singular, like, favorite or best rising to the surface. Say for the, you know, using the Gilcrease as an example, I think our painting Shoshone Falls by Thomas Moran, our 10-foot-wide waterfall painting, is probably the most famous single artwork out of our collection. And I think you could make an argument, you know, the kind of one of the most impactful. But that's, I mean, I've got so many favorites beyond and in addition to that in the collection.
Catherine, when you're at a cocktail party or dinner party, and the question is always, well, hi, I'm so-and-so, what do you do? And you say, I'm a curator. What questions follow that usually?
I like to say, if people give me this blank look, like, what's a curator? I say...
You work at Starbucks?
I have the best job. I get to play with the art. Yeah. Actually, when my daughter was in junior high, she said, oh, my friend said to me, doesn't your mom work at Philbrook? She has... What is she? It starts with a C. Is she a custodian? And I said, no. She said, no, it's a curator. And she was, you know, had to explain what that was. But I like to just say, I get to play with the art and present it and put together presentations.
I like what you said, play. I mean, is there an element of play, Laura, in the, some of the work that you do in terms of when? What's the moment in the process of something where you have the most opportunity to kind of be the most creative, I guess, is kind of where I'm going with that.
I think kind of in that first quarter or third of a project of pulling together an exhibition, because that's where we are deep in the vaults, pulling out racks, getting out works that no one's seen in a decade, taking in as much as we possibly can, researching artworks that might be in other collections, and you'll see visual connections that never occurred to you, and you'll get new ideas, or you might talk to a colleague who says, hey, have you ever heard about this thing over here? So that early stage is really exciting, and oftentimes that's before a lot of the hard deadlines fall, so it's not quite as stressful. But when you really get to research the works themselves and spend a lot of time with the artwork, seeing this like creative output from our collections and from other museums is also really inspiring for us, and it's just it helps your own creative juices get flowing.
What's your favorite part, Catherine, in terms of, you know, when you're like right now you're in the middle of a big exhibition and it's in the kind of that critical phase where you're a couple of weeks out from it opening. You know, what part do you enjoy the most and what part is the most difficult?
This would be both most enjoyable and most difficult would be, I'll give an example. We have three pieces coming from the Smithsonian for this show that's opening in about 2 or 3 weeks, and I didn't know if these pieces would be coming from the Smithsonian because it's mostly closed right now. So fortunately, they're making a huge effort, staying late, packing the pieces, but I was following the email string today that the truck was coming and the pieces were being loaded and they were staying late for it. So that is incredibly exciting that the pieces are on. It's almost like expecting a baby, you know? You just... These pieces that you know so well yet don't know are coming. So that's really exciting. Also, just walking through the gallery when the walls are up and the colors are in. I said to somebody, oh my gosh, my stomach is nervous, but I had this huge smile on my face.
Yeah, it's kind of bitter and sweet kind of element. Laura, when you're traveling around going to other museums, not on a official capacity, but just for vacation or whatever, can you look at other people's shows without reorganizing their things and judging every little element of it?
No.
What are the pet peeves? Let's talk about that. You go in a show, these things really piss you off more than anything else.
Oh, goodness. My husband and I both work in the museum field, so when we're on vacation, we're terrible. Like, we're going into a museum and saying, why is the text so small on the label? Like, what were they thinking, you know? So sometimes it's some of the signage, and that's such a simple thing to think about. And it's sometimes, you know, as you're planning all these details to pull an exhibition together, sometimes, like, it's an easy one to forget about, you know, like, or to like, so it's really, we... our team at Gilcrease is great about, you know, making sure that we've got good standards for people to be able to easily read or just some of those simple details. I think some museums overlook and have like the 12-point fonts on, you know, in Times New Roman in gray on black, and you're like, so some of those things that are so easy. It's not about having a giant budget or having a huge staff, but museums of any scale can really shift some of those things pretty easily.
Catherine, what drives you crazy that you see? We don't have to name names. We'd prefer if you do, but you don't have to name names. But that you see in other museums, because you were in New York recently, you were going to all kinds of places. You know, what are some things you see that really just get you crazy?
I think stuff that you really notice that you shouldn't notice. Seams... label colors that don't work, and so the labels are more prominent than the artwork. things like
that. Is that because it kind of takes you, is it because it takes you out of the experience?
Yeah. If you don't notice something, they're doing their job. And I think if it, you're just completely enveloped by the space and the experience, then that's a good show.
It's like when you go see a film and there was some amazing thing and you go, someone at the end tells you that that was an effect and you didn't even realize it. It's like, that's a great special effect, you know? And not when you're in the middle of it going, hey, look at these special effects, they're amazing. Laura, when you're thinking about the future, we talked about the, you know, how you, people, how we kind of see the career and these milestones and mile markers in our lives. How far are you, not maybe sitting down and planning things out, but thinking about, you know, are you thinking 5 years, 10 years out? You know, how do you kind of go about, because these are not short projects, these are long-term things.
No, and that's one of the things that often surprises our guests, is that it will take us a really quick exhibition preparation time is 2 years. A show like Albert Bierstadt, that took us about 3 years to pull all of that together, and it's not unusual for a show to take 4 to 5 years to plan. So right now, I mean, in terms of just brainstorming in my own head, I'm thinking, you know, 6 to 10 years out. And it's, who knows, there's a lot of factors that could change within that time, but the more concrete planning is really within the next like 3 to 4 years. But we're still, you know, you've always got kind of a list of potential ideas in the back of your head that maybe someday you could bring to fruition. So that's kind of always going.
Last question I'm going to give, I'd like an answer from both of you, which is, what are you most excited about the job at this point in your career? What makes you kind of get up out of bed in the morning and want to go do?
For me, I deal with historic and dead artists. The museum field is changing a lot, and contemporary art is and should be a part of almost every presentation. So when I was talking about stretching, I think for me that's something that's critical and important and makes historic exhibitions vital, whether you're talking about issues that are contemporary and sometimes artist installations that make that, bring that into the present. Just bringing things into the present, I guess, is for me challenging and exciting. And as I said, whether it's just a current event or a topic you need to discuss, or if it's a contemporary artist responding to. And I just think that's something that for me is a little newer, but it's exciting and it's challenging.
I think one of the things that's really exciting right now that's happening across the museum field is broadening the concept of curating. I mean, museums as an entity have only been around a couple hundred years. They've constantly been changing. But there's now, I think, recognition that knowledge and expertise doesn't only come from a university, but can come from a much broader knowledge pool and base. And so as museums, we're trying more to connect with a variety of cultures to find more entry points within to our collections. And so it's really about like finding new connections to people and to our public that I think is really exciting. And for me personally, getting to work with the Gilcrease Collection is just always spectacular. So I never fails any time I go into our vaults or through our galleries just to be continually amazed by some of the works there. So that's a real treasure.
How lucky are we to have these two in our community here? Huh? Let's hear it for Catherine Whitney and Laura Fry, everybody. Thank you guys for joining us. This was fun. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tonight's edition of Museum Confidential is brought to you by the exit sign. You're in a museum. You're way tired or way lost or just way beyond caring about what's hanging on the walls. You need the way out. Enter the exit sign. That utilitarian means of escape, departure, sweet release, the finish line. Museums are big places. That's part of what makes them special. We do want you, since you bothered to come here, to look, linger, roam, gaze, and wander. And we are not going for a casino kind of vibe. If you need to take a break, get some air, leave the building, that is your right. Look for the glowing greenness or redness that reads exit, and go from there. Just bail with our blessing. The exit symbol is signage as salvation, a beacon for all who seek it, a tether for the clueless. These softly lit lifelines are ever present and indeed required by law. But rules and regulations vary, so please check local listings. We're told that the fine print found on certain exit signs in California actually stipulates that you can check out any time you like, but you can never leave.
As we often say, there are many kinds of museums. In 1992, a man named Barry Levinson, not to be confused with the Academy Award-winning director of Rain Man, left his job as Assistant Attorney General for the state of Wisconsin to become founder and curator of the National Mustard Museum in the town of Middleton, Wisconsin. With nearly 7,000 mustards from all 50 states and more than 70 countries, the museum is just 2.5 hours from Chicago and a mere 6,978 kilometers from Dijon, France. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.
And that is Museum Confidential for today. You can catch new episodes of the podcast, including the one posting tomorrow, Friday, which will include a conversation recorded live in New Orleans earlier this month, at publicradiotulsa.org, again, publicradiotulsa.org. And when you go there, click on the podcast tab. Also, you can find Museum Confidential at iTunes, Spotify, and the NPR One app. I am Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Thank you for tuning in for Studio Tulsa.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Rigsby at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.